The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
It's quite astonishing to see the disconnect between what politicians and activists and bureaucrats were saying at the UN climate conference in Scotland and the real observational data. You know, Jay, I find that really amazing. I mean, how can they say all these things that don't match with the actual physical science?
Well, it's really simple, Tom, and it's all part of the woke generation and the woke philosophy. I guess woke is short for awakened, but they've stated very clearly that feelings matter more than facts. I mean, they're absolutely rejecting facts. They're creating new history. It's really amazing. And as a result, science is losing. The scientific method that you and I have depended on all through our lives is being buried. It's being forgotten. You can just decide on anything you want. Actually, it really goes back to Plato. Plato and Aristotle had very different ways looking at science these many thousands of years ago. Aristotle was an experimenter, an observer. Plato just made stuff up. He would see a problem and he would just make up what the answer was without any evidence. Aristotle was really beginning the scientific method, and it's losing out right now, Tom, and it's an absolute disaster. I'm an optimist. I think the pendulum will swing back and people will begin to see through what's being done. But for the moment, it's a disgrace.
Yeah. Well, you know, this woke postmodernism is really quite a cancer overwhelming America. I mean, we're seeing it in all kinds of areas like critical race theory, you know, post-colonialism, you know, telling us that there's differences between black and white. You know, we have institutional racism. And of course, the fact is, when you look at all these things from a factual point of view, they don't match what they're saying. So you're right. It's being driven largely by feelings and identity groups. And the thing that scares me, Jay, is that postmodern thinkers, they reject the very fundamentals of our modern society. I mean, the things that, you know, led to the philosophy known as liberalism, like freedom of expression, respect for viewpoint diversity, and sincere debate. I mean, the cancel culture, they just stop you. They just won't discuss. In fact, they consider our method of discussion even something that is based on white, male, heterosexual philosophy. And so they reject even the method of evidence-based decision-making, for example.
Your analogy with cancer, working through the body now, wokeism working through society is absolutely accurate. But I remain optimistic because I think they're overlooking, now that they have the administration and are power mad and feel like they can do anything to remaking society, I think they're totally overlooking the feelings of society. And I believe that is going to come back to bite them. I'm really very optimistic that they will ultimately fail. They are in the saddle right now and will be for the next year. But I think they'll see how the public feels in the midterm elections next November. I am totally confident that the Republicans will win back both the House and the Senate, the House in a landslide, the Senate in a very small majority, and certainly people recognize the Republican politicians aren't a lot better than the Democrats, but there are enough good people running for the House in the coming election that I think things will change and we'll begin to win back our country. And hopefully the science will benefit as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You know, the interesting thing is that our guest today actually is an expert on understanding the scientific method, which, believe it or not, these woke postmodernists, they completely reject the scientific method as a fundamental way to understand the world. Our guest today is Ken Happala. You know, after passing his doctoral exams in economics with a minor in mathematics, Ken taught on the university level and engaged in mathematical modeling in economics. He began to question much of what he taught and the results of a great deal of economic modeling. You know, it's interesting, Jay, that over the past 12 years, Ken has been vice president and then president of the Science and Environment Policy Project, SEPP. SEPP, of course, as you know, was a nonprofit group that was established by atmospheric physicist Dr. Fred Singer in 1990, and they strive to clarify the diverse problems facing the planet and, where necessary, arrive at effective, cost-conscious solutions. You know, one of the things that SEP has actually dug into, Jay, and it's really great, is the so-called climate emergency. I mean, the great thing about interviewing Ken is that, you know, they're using physical evidence of over 40 years of atmospheric temperature trends to talk about the fact that the globe is not warming dangerously. So he's a great person to have on today. So welcome to the show, Ken.
Thank you, Jay and Tom.
Well, Ken, you started your career in economics, worked on economic models for the government. When did you move away from economics towards science, where your career is right now?
Well, I started to move away while I was teaching, still teaching. One day I was putting up a fairly common concept in economics called the balanced budget multiplier. And it was straight out of the text. And after I dismissed the class, I looked at what I wrote on a chalkboard and started thinking about it. I said, this doesn't make sense. If I apply limit theory, then the most powerful economy in the world was that of the Soviet Union. Uh-huh. At the time, we had distinguished professors in economics claiming the economy of the Soviet Union was comparable to that of the United States. And I didn't buy it. Fortunately, I knew some economists who could read and write economics in Russian, and they didn't buy it at all. They said, nobody's reading the real stuff, that the economy in the Soviet Union is under real trouble for the general people. They had a powerful military, no bones about that, a very powerful military, but the underlying economy was extremely weak. So that continued, and then what really set me off totally from continuing with it was I was asked to, under a federal government, to review the economic policies on energy as they were being done using energy models, claiming that the U.S. was about to run out of natural gas and out of oil, and that the world was about to run out of oil. I knew enough about the industry to realize we had lots of natural gas in the Gulf of Mexico in what is called gas hydrates. And it was a problem of getting at it. We also had a lot of natural gas and oil in what they call source rock, which is where oil and gas come from and assemble into pools, which is the traditional method of obtaining it. Now, these were technological problems. They were not physical problems. And with the models, I pointed out severe problems in the mathematics itself. I don't wish to go into that.
Ken, let me stop you there for a moment because we don't want to go into the math, but you and I followed a fairly similar course around the same time. The fellow who really started this whole idea of running out of oil, sadly, was a mentor of mine, M. King Hubbard,
yes,
who said that back around 1960-ish that we were at peak oil, and that was described as the years that we would be using more than we discovered. And while Hubbard was a brilliant petroleum geologist that I had the good fortune to work with, he really was not much of a sociologist and didn't really understand man's brain. He saw everything static. So he talked about peak oil as though no idea that we discover new ways to investigate for oil and gas, new ways of refining it, new sources. So he really was old school beyond belief. Happily, while he was my mentor, I saw an inconsistency there. Just in with common sense, you saw it mathematically. Now, I want to ask you, I would assume it was when you met Fred Singer, another very dear friend of mine for decades before his passing. And he had, I assume, started the Science and Environmental Policy Project before you met him and was able to get you to work with him. How did that occur?
At one time, I was the president of the oldest science society in Washington, formed in Washington, and we met at the Cosmos Club, which Fred was a member there, and I met Fred through that society. And we had great meetings with a diverse number of people to include veterans of the nuclear Manhattan Project and things like that. They have great stories. But I got to know Fred that way, and I made several presentations at the Cosmos Club on issues that I was interested in, on scientific issues. And Fred and I met a number of times, and then he asked me to join him at SEP. At the time, it was a fortunate opportunity for me simply because I had been involved in various types of real estate investments, and I realized that the market was changing dramatically, and I had to get out of it, and I had to do something else. And so it just worked out well for me. Fred asked me almost right away to start doing our weekly bulletin, the week that was. And I expanded it from about 5 to 7 pages to roughly running around 25 pages, of which 5 to 7 pages are original writing. Mm-hmm. We review what we consider to be the most important newspaper articles or posts by other people in on the internet that our readers can access, and we give links to those, often with comments whether we think the thing, where we think the weaknesses are, if there are some.
Yeah, we've been in your SEP, which is really great for us. So thanks so much for that.
You're welcome.
You appear, Ken, to be a one-man army there. I'm wondering if you have help and what your funding sources are to keep going, doing such a great job and putting out this terrific newsletter.
Well, I'm fortunate in that I have 5 great editors, 4 of whom are distinguished physicists, Cork Hayden or Howard Hayden, Tom Sheehan, PhD from MIT in physics. They're both retired, and they're working diligently in helping me put things in English versus equations or in jargon concepts. And that's really hard.
Yeah.
That's very difficult.
Well, that's an all-star. Yeah, Tom and Howard Hayden, I mean, that's really an all-star cast, and that really tells me a lot. I really look forward to your weekly newsletter to learn after my career is stretching 65 years after college and I try to learn something every day, and your newsletter has really helped me to be a career learner.
Thank you. I hope we all will be career learners, because our life is learning is a journey that changes as information changes and things like that. And hopefully we can all learn from it as information changes.
You know, I have a rule that I live by that strangely enough has not failed me on a single day in my life. And the rule is I want to go to bed every day smarter than I woke up. Now, the bar is low. That is to say, I don't have to learn some really earth-shaking piece of information, but I want to learn something in the course of my day. I've never failed. Actually, I've never met a human being that couldn't teach me something. I could be in the basement of a building watching a janitor sweep the floor, and I could ask him some questions and I would learn something. And it's been a philosophy that works well for me. When I read the SEP newsletter every week, what I learn is of much heavier material, and it makes that day a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Ken, Jay and I have been looking at this woke philosophy quite a bit, their ability to reject facts and focus on feelings. Now, we think it's been a pretty destructive force in science, and we fear that a generation of young people are being led astray. How do you think we can fight against that?
I think that the best way is purely sticking with the evidence. Mm-hmm. And don't exaggerate. Don't get in the same trap that they're in of saying things which aren't true through exaggeration. And eventually, I think that it's the American public. I'm not talking about Canada here because I don't know it well enough. But I think the American public is very resilient. And it's not buying the woke philosophy. The advocates in the U.S. claim they were elected on that principle, but they're not. And I think we saw it in Virginia this year, where I'm a resident, that they rejected it, and quite soundly, in their election for governor, who just announced today that he's rejecting the idea of this mutual pack of Northeast states called REGI, Regional Greenhouse Gas Emissions, and he's pulling out of it. And the political pressure is on. It's just, we have to maintain that. We have to support those who are rejecting the idea that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that will cause dangerous global warming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we agree that the election in Virginia may have been a real turning point. And what excites me about it is I have a sense that it's given a backbone to many politicians who feel that way, but worry about, you know, coming out with ideas that reject the green philosophy that is being adapted by the Northeast states in that so-called REGI program. And we, Tom and I, had played a song a few weeks ago by a white rapper named Tom McDonald. And we broke down his song into seven segments. And surprisingly, this highly tattooed, normal rapper created a song for young people absolutely rejecting wokeism from beginning to end. And that was a real optimistic position for us to adopt. So what you just said, that it's being rejected, is absolutely true. And that's why when we see the election of next November, we're going to see not just one data point like the Virginia election. I think the people really will have spoken. And I see very little chance that it won't be that way. Of course, a lot of people say, oh, they'll rig the election as they likely did the presidential election. I think it's a lot harder to rig an election of, I think, 535 House seats, although they'll definitely play tricks. I think they're using the pandemic over and over again to control us. They'll probably come up with a new strain and new mask regulations. We're going to see craziness come October as we lead up to the November election. But I'm as optimistic as you that the public is rejecting it. And you wouldn't know that in the media. The leftists own the media. And so over and over again, every day, it's drilled into regular folks, the philosophy that they're putting forward. But I'm quite confident that people are getting tired of it.
Well, surely one of the things that's going to happen is we're going to see more Texas-type blackouts, because while they may feel and be emotionally attached to wind turbines and things that don't actually work in an effective way, in a reliable way, they'll suffer blackouts. I mean, surely, Ken, what's going to happen is that reality is going to bite hard. And in the middle of the winter, they're going to have no power if they just simply go with the woke philosophy.
I think you're right. I think we're seeing this quite well in the UK, which is much further down the path of economic destruction via wind power than the US is. All of a sudden, people are waking up saying, nobody's told us about the cost of wind power and how much it how much electricity costs when the wind doesn't blow. Mm-hmm. And it's that when the wind doesn't blow that it becomes devastatingly expensive.
Ken, I just wrote a three-part series on the absurdity of wind power in CFACT.org, Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. And every week for the last 3 weeks, I put together a series on wind. But I was thrilled and shocked that a couple of days ago, I saw an article by a very liberal woman by the name of Katie Singer, no relation to Fred, in a very long letter to President Biden, warning him about wind turbines. And I asked my wife to print the whole article. And she said, Jay, the woman who wrote this is clearly a leftist of the first order. Why would you want her article? And I said, because she wrote a very honest article showing all the problems, maybe better than I did in my three-part series, of wind turbines. So there's a data point that somebody who believes that we should be getting rid of fossil fuel recognized that wind turbines played a big role in the very cold time in February of Texas, where they came minutes away from losing the entire grid. So that's another data point that there are people waking up to the truth, even though they basically are not on our side of the debate.
Yeah, I'll include a link actually to this particular article, because, you know, she points out that the various materials needed for wind turbines, for example, are primarily mined in China, you know, and he says, and I'm just reading a quote, this region was once organic farmland. Now it's a wasteland. So, you know, this is a left winger, presumably, who's writing an open letter to Biden pointing out reality. So, I mean, Ken, that sounds like a pretty good move.
Yeah, there was an effort to say that the Blue Northerner that hit Texas was an unusual event. And we have these guys that run all sorts of probability numbers that they totally make up without a theoretical foundation, saying that this was unusual. But in the 1880s, there were three such events that hit Texas, Nebraska, and Kansas. One of them froze cattle in North Texas. They froze out on the plains. Another one killed many school children on their way home from school. That was called a school children's storm. It was so bad that Teddy Roosevelt, who was certainly a promoter of the West, began to wonder if the West was fit for a habitation, that is the plain states. It's nothing unusual with extreme weather events and these blue northerners to come blasting in. And Texas is going to get another one.
Without a doubt. And actually, we've forgotten and have not really made as big a deal as we should over Michael Moore, one of the top leftists in the country, helped to make a movie called Planet for the Humans. He produced the movie, didn't actually narrate it, wasn't in the movie, but in it, there was lengthy segments exposing wind and solar for what they are, which is of no value whatsoever, and the incredible lies they tell. They showed a big concert out west that was supposed to be entirely produced with solar power, and they discovered behind a curtain a diesel generator that was actually energizing the whole thing. And Moore's film, Planet for the Humans, you can still find it on the internet, but the left was temporarily very upset with what he did. He had a 2-minute segment, one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen, that compressed everything bad about wind and solar in rapid time all over the world, the mining, the slavery, the materials, how China controls it all. In the most amazing 2 minutes of film I've ever seen. It came and went. We probably should be making more of it, but it's another leftist seeing reality. I suppose they don't want to freeze themselves.
Yeah. Actually, I'll put a link to that 2-minute clip right under the podcast when it goes online on Monday so people can hear it. It is, they can see it too. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, Ken. So when we get back after the break, what we hope to talk to you about is the scientific method. Could you explain it in a brief manner that our listeners can really get a hold of? Because that is crucially important to the advancement of science that led to the modern world in many ways. And in fact, it's being rejected by the woke postmodernisms. So Ken, when we come back, can we talk about the scientific method?
Absolutely. Love to. I want to give you an update on Healthy Cell Focus and Recall Supplement. This is important. I'm about ready to take one now. It's the morning. I am in a flurry of activities. I have to get this report filed with America Out Loud Talk Radio. And these are gel-based vitamin supplements. Focus and Recall has 6 major domains. First is focus and neurotransmitters, with L-threonine, glycine, and L-tyrosine, recall mental speed and rapid learning, alpha-lipoic acid, and phosphatidylserine, brain flow and support, curcumin and taurine, green coffee bean extract, brain cell, oxidative, antioxidative activity, lutein, black pepper, fruit and extract, and lastly, cognitive fuel, brain energy, omega-3, 6, and 9, MCT oil, vitamin B6, and B12. Now, is it proven that these can improve your memory and make a significant impact in your overall mental function? I have to tell you, that's really up to you to give it a try. But I can tell you right now, I am not going to gamble without taking a Healthy Cell today. These are wonderful products. There's no downside to them. Go to healthycell.com and put in the promotional box Out Loud to get 20% off your next purchase of Healthy Cell products. So let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
So, Ken, can you talk about the scientific method, focusing especially on the part that the woke people are missing, that is the comparison between observational evidence and what's, you know, the models are forecasting or their theories or their feelings? Can you talk about it, you know, in a way that our listeners can understand?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I spent a long time trying to figure out what the scientific method meant. When I started working in economics, I read a lot of philosophy and I knew of the scientific method, but to try to put it simply was extremely difficult. Then I ran across the writings of Richard Feynman, a Nobel laureate in physics and a brilliant teacher. And his lectures are just fabulous. To quote Feynman, science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. What does he mean by that? Question everything. Take no one's word for it. Question the assumptions, the logical reasoning, the physical evidence, and the results. Test the results against all the physical evidence you can find. If the results don't work against test against the physical evidence, you have not done the science correctly. Mm-hmm. We're implementing this with SEP, in the sense that we look at various studies and we test how do they stand up against the general physical evidence. And as one noted physicist told me, I seem to have a knack for finding the weaknesses in everything because I test it. Mm-hmm. And that's the best way to me of defining what is meant by the scientific method. How does it stand up to the physical evidence? We're not talking about computer models as physical evidence. They're not physical.
Well, let me jump in here with two points. One, currently, we're always reading about consensus. A whole bunch of people believe in this. And the public seems to accept the idea if a lot of people agree with something, it must be right. Consensus has no place in science whatsoever. And the greatest proof of that, when Albert Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, a huge number of scientists didn't agree with him, such that in Germany, 100 scientists who disagreed with Einstein got together and wrote a book. And the book was titled 100 German Scientists Who Disagree with Einstein's Theory of Relativity. Einstein's reaction to it was, if I was wrong, it would only take one scientist to disprove me, not 100. And that supports exactly your quote from Richard Feynman.
So, Jay, you know, it's funny because people talk about consensus, but surely there's examples in history where the consensus was wrong And in fact, the scientist who proposed something unusual was right. Can you give us another example of that?
I'll give you three. Many of us have used Listerine as a mouthwash. Well, Joseph Lister discovered, back in the mid 17 or 1800s, that the germ theory, there were doctors moving from a morgue to a birthing room and carrying germs with them, and nobody accepted the germ theory. It took over 50 years before anyone paid attention to Joseph Lister. Well, more commonly, when most of our listeners were younger, they probably remember that if you got an ulcer, it was because you had a type A personality, you were nervous and too hard driving. It took two Australian scientists to discover that the ulcer was related to a particular bacteria called H. pylori. And if you didn't have that bacteria, you didn't get an ulcer. And if you did have it, you could get an ulcer. Well, that took certainly 50 years to be accepted, and it was accepted in most of our lifetimes. But the one that affected me the most was Alfred Wegener, who talked about continental drift early in the 20th century, was laughed at and disgraced. When I was a student at Princeton, one of my professors introduced the idea that Wegener was right, and that all the continents that looked like they fit together once were fit together. So consensus has been an obstacle to science from the beginning of history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ken, Jay and I write about science every week in a manner that we find is, pretty easy to understand, we think. But too many scientists seem to not want to be understood. I mean, they're not working to be understood. Are they trying to be, sort of obscure? What do you think that is the problem?
I think jargon is something very hard to overcome. Jargon is very efficient when you're talking with people who understand the jargon.
Mm-hmm.
You can convey complex concepts quite quickly if both parties thoroughly understand what is being spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And it is tough to put things down in English. In understandable English. That's one of the things that we try to do at SEP, explain complex things in a way that most intelligent people can understand them.
Mm-hmm.
Again, using as a guideline, Richard Feynman, he said, you don't really understand anything until you can explain it to a sixth grader, or to that effect. That's not a direct quote.
Yeah,
and that's in effect my target audience. If I can get it to junior high school level, then I know I'm doing something. Or they have to understand English, but I know that I'm being successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Tom and I strive to do exactly that. Now, my wife, who's a lot smarter than me, but doesn't have any training in science, and I'm writing about science all the time, I have her read all of my manuscripts. And without any training in science, if she can't understand everything, then I've made a mistake. Now, I semi-joke with people that in having written literally at this point thousands of essays, participated in 35 books, that I've been lucky not to be the smartest person in the room, not to have a genius IQ. I've always had to work very hard to understand things, and I think that's made me a good teacher and a good writer. I know in the sporting field, people who are really great athletes make terrible coaches. Michael Jordan was a bust as a basketball coach. So was Wayne Gretzky as a hockey coach. So it takes somebody of a little more average intelligence to understand other people's ability to understand things. And it's really wonderful, except that you work so hard to achieve that. And Tom and I do the very same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we should emphasize that the website is sepp.org. Is that right, Ken?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's where people should go if they want to start learning about what is the real science in climate change. Yeah. You know, it's funny, you were talking about how scientists have a hard time sometimes explaining things quickly. And it reminded me of a funny story about Albert Einstein. 2 years before he died in 55, he was on a radio station in the year that I was born, actually, 53. And they were coming to the end of the broadcast. And the announcer said to Albert Einstein, he said, "Dr. Einstein, we have about 30 seconds left in our program today. Do you think in that time you could, for our listening audience, summarize your theory of general relativity?" And Einstein paused and said, "No." And so they had to go to commercial early, because I mean, sometimes these concepts, you know, are just simply not explainable in 30 seconds. And that's a big problem, because we seem to only have attention in our society for 30 second sound clips or news clips, you know. And
well,
so,
you know, let me jump in here. Of course, Einstein's first visit to the United States was to make a series of lectures at Princeton University back in the 20s. And I think he did five lectures on five consecutive days. And the first one was at Princeton University's largest classroom that held a lecture hall that held 600 people. And it was standing room only for lecture one. But as the lectures continued, his fifth lecture was held in a room with only 20 chairs, because that's all they needed. As his lecture series went on, people realized they couldn't understand it, so they didn't come back for the next one. I actually have undertaken a desire to try to simplify the theory of relativity. I have all his books, and they're not easy to understand, and I write weekly for CFAC.org. And when I told them that I was going to try to write a series of lectures and make the theory of relativity better understood, no one was very excited about it, probably because they thought I would fail, which may be, and it's a long-term project, but I'm having fun reading Einstein stuff and trying to simplify it. Of course, I might simplify it and get it wrong, but it's been a fun project for me. Well, Ken, I want to throw a curveball to you right now. I tend to be swimming upstream with a lot of scientists in the area of climate change and global warming. I may be the only person, maybe the only person you've heard say it. I consider man's impact in terms of thermostat, the impact on the thermostat of the Earth, as being zero. That's the default number. I believe totally that the default number of man's impact on the temperature of the Earth is zero. Now, there are hundreds of colleagues that are on our side of the global warming issue. They know that the left presents what they present is an absolute fraud. We're not destroying the Earth. The world isn't going to end in 12 years or 8 years or 7 years, but they are spending much of their careers trying to find some number of zeros to the right of the decimal that man's impact on the temperature of the planet does exist, and it's some little number. They all agree that it's insignificant, that our impact on the temperature of the planet is insignificant. But by working to find what that number is, no matter how many zeros to the right of the decimal point, they give an opening to our opposition, to our enemy. They give them the proverbial inch, which the opposition uses to take a mile. What are your thoughts?
That's a very good point, Jay. Up to recently, I would say very comfortably, the other side is greatly exaggerating what they're saying, and here is the evidence. The most obvious evidence is what's happening in the atmosphere, the temperature trends of the atmosphere, which are influenced both by nature and by humanity, human emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. This year, I could point more holes into their theory. For example, that the sun does not have a big role on Earth's climate. I think there's a big difference in the astrophysicist community, and that's been brought out. And the sun probably has a significant role. We just don't know how much.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find very significant in the last couple of years is the work of Windegarden and Happer. Windegarden is with the University of York. Happer is retired from the Princeton. And that gives us the physical evidence to say that the influence of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases is very small. And in the nature of global climate change, it is probably about 1% of what changes naturally. Carbon dioxide is important in small concentrations. The greenhouse effect is very important in small concentrations because it keeps the Earth warmer. It keeps the land masses from freezing, reaching temperatures in the minus 40 degrees F. I'm throwing that out because we don't look, it's impossible to calculate. And at night, the land masses on Earth would get too cold for plant life, would be on a barren planet.
Mm.
So the greenhouse effect is very important for life on this planet. But at around 200 parts per million, which is not sufficient for most plant life to survive. Most plant life will die at less at 100 parts per million. I don't think I said 200. 100 parts per million. At around 100 parts per million, the effectiveness of carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas disappears, mm-hmm. virtually disappears. It becomes extremely modest. And this is totally misunderstood by the climate change community. And I think that the work of Windegarden and Happer have shown it. It is based upon physical evidence compiled over 40 years. They use the HITRAN database, which is with the Harvard Smithsonian Institute, to make their calculations. So I think we're establishing the physical evidence to say not only is the influence of carbon dioxide very small and the other side is incorrect, we have a far better method of analyzing the greenhouse effect than the one being used. It works. We can test it against the physical evidence compiled by different means that's occurring in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So, and this is also confirmed by decades of experiments in spectroscopy, which has to do with how electromagnetic energy, including visible and not visible light, and matter interact. This is how we begin to understand how the stars work and things like that. So, we have gone far beyond, or some researchers have gone far beyond the trap they're in with the climate modeling industry. because the climate modeling industry has to deal with a problem that has never been solved in physics for over 100 years, and that is what happens when you have turbulent flow of fluids. We're dealing in the Earth system, we have water, the oceans, we have the atmosphere, both fluids, and we can't describe the turbulent flow of fluids. Mm-hmm. The weather projections, forecasts break down within 14 days. And that's only if all the models are converging with like that last that long. Many mm-hmm. times they break down in 5 to 8 days.
And yeah, well, most of us know that our local weatherman who gets paid to be wrong most of the time, 7 days out is correct on average 56%. And you're, adding more information to that from a scientific purpose, that the turbulence in the atmosphere makes it virtually impossible to go past 14 days. And yet the people on the other side want to change our economy based on projections that go out decades, if not a century. It's absolutely absurd. I want to ask you a question of great importance to our listeners now, Ken. What advice would you give them to evaluate the science stories they read in the news every day?
Good question. The first thing I would say, what is the physical evidence? And here I again refer to the physical evidence we're collecting in the atmosphere. If the story that they're reading has anything to do with greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, then does the evidence that's being presented, is it consistent with what's occurring in the atmosphere? A very, very modest warming. If it has to do with the probability of extreme weather event taking place, all I can say is that's junk science, because it is without any basis in theoretical statistics in probability theory. They created an entire mass of studies that have no foundation. They're just sitting out there without a foundation. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would suggest. Does it match physical evidence, or is it pure speculation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a slightly different kind of question, and that is, I always found that Fred Singer was a bit like a kindly grandfather. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about him and what he was like as a person?
He was a very generous man, and I think you're right. Later in his career, when I knew him, he was more like a kindly grandfather figure. Earlier in his career, he was more aggressive, and he was a brilliant scientist in understanding or learning about space. He was constantly learning, and he encouraged a lot of people to become involved in the climate questions, and also encouraged a lot of people to be involved in space exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I love that stuff. To end off, we only have a few minutes to go. Can you talk about your long and short-term plans for the science and environmental policy project?
The short-term plans are to continue doing what we're doing in the sense of analyzing various papers and studies that come out using the scientific method. As I mentioned, I think we feel pretty comfortable now that not only can we point out what's wrong with a lot of the work that comes out, but we can point out a better method of using to uncover how the climate changes. It's mostly natural. Very little has to do with human if you measure from the atmosphere. If you're measuring it from the ground level, it's what it is urbanization. That's the biggest cause of climate change, building cities. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change global climate. It changes local and regional climate. And you have other changes like land use changes, irrigation. When I lived out in the Phoenix area, you could tell irrigation season because the night didn't get cold at night. And a desert gets cold at night. That's a matter of water vapor in the air. What we're going to be doing over the next few years is making a better effort to get the message across to the general community versus into the community of skeptics alone. I'm dropping commentaries in the Wall Street Journal probably weekly, and I'll be doing that more often. And using other newspapers, again, with the purpose of not attacking the other side, but saying there's a better way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And how can our listeners get your weekly newsletters that I've already bragged about, that I learned so much from every week? How can our listeners obtain that newsletter?
Go to www.sepp.org and hit the week that was button. It's a button on the top tab that will tell you how you can sign up for the newsletter. And we post it every week on the website so they can go directly to the website as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that you're listed as a nonprofit 501c3 educational organization. So does that suggest that the average person can donate to your group if they like it?
We love it. Our budget is small. Our books are audited by an established independent CPA. We file our 990s with the IRS. They're publicly available, and we have a tiny budget, and we could always use extra money. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's a good way to end, because certainly I encourage people to go to sepp.org and learn about the best physical evidence that, in fact, over 40 years of atmospheric temperature trends, you know, during the period when the greenhouse gas effect supposedly was causing a huge problem, we can actually see in the data that the globe is not warming dangerously. And SEPP is a major promoter of that idea and proves it with good, solid science facts. So, Ken, it's been really great having you on. This is Tom Harris and Dr. Jay Lair signing out from The Other Side of the Story.